Digital Media Insider, Episode 21, January 4, 2008. Welcome to Digital Media Insider from O'Reilly.com. On our website, we explore the future of audio, video, and photography to help you get more creative with technology. I'm David Bettino, and I edit the audio section of the site. Today's show is all about remixing, transforming a multi-track recording into something fresh through creative editing and overdubbing. To get the scoop, I spoke with Francis Prev, author of The Remixer's Bible. As you'll hear, he's not just speaking theoretically. Francis produced 6 top 10 Billboard remixes last year alone. To give you an idea of his style, here's a before and after example. First, we'll hear the original version of Stranger by Hilary Duff. Then we'll hear the Prev remix, a collaboration with DJ Joe Bermudez that hit number 1 on the Billboard Club Play chart last summer. Nobody believes me when I tell them that you're out of your mind. Nobody believes me when I tell them that there's so much to hide. There's no kindness in your eyes. The way you look at me is just not. We'll hear more examples of Francis Prev's remixing throughout the show. To begin, I asked him how a remix starts.
What'll happen is when you're doing a track and you want it to get, you know, move into the club scene, there are a lot of different sort of niches in the club scene, various, you know, styles. Like you might have, you know, trance, house. There was a phenomenon called the circuit party, which was very popular, and then it's sort of like a rave, but for muscular gay men. Each of these types of music, or, you know, these scenes, you know, has its own sound. So when a record label would want a track to appeal to a specific audience, what they do is they'd get one of the leaders in that sound to do their interpretation of the track. And generally when you do a remix, what happens is if it's a vocal track, you keep the vocal and maybe some of the core musical elements from the track, and you throw everything else out and you create your own new song in a new style using those elements. So it's sort of like extremely glamorous, high-quality loop libraries. The next thing that happens alternately is you may be working with an instrumental track. A lot of the underground tracks just don't have vocals of any sort. Hmm. So what you'll do is you'll try to find the hook, the big idea behind that track, and incorporate that into a new composition that you create. And different remixers are hired for their expertise or their sound or their following. A lot of DJs will have, you know, very passionate followings, you know, among other DJs and club goers. For instance, Gabriel and Dresden have a huge following among club DJs. So when a label wants a track that's going to reach that audience, you know, they call Josh and Dave and say, hey, you got time to do a remix.
So the phone rings and what do you hear?
Generally, it's an email.
Okay.
basically, I'll either get a call directly or an email directly from a label, or I'll be contacted by one of the DJs that I do the music and production for, like, you know, for instance, Joe Bermudez. I used to do a lot of work with Roland Balmaris as well. So Joe will send me an email saying, hey, I just got the new Hilary Duff remix, or I just got the new Justice remix, and you know, I wanted to see if I can get on your calendar. And then Joe and I will figure out kind of what direction we want to go. And lately we've been doing stuff that tends to be on the commercial side of the electro sound. and Joe will send me the tracks, generally the vocal, and I'll just spend an afternoon or two in my studio taking that vocal and writing lots and lots of music around it, and like bass lines and so on and so forth. And then after a couple of days, I'll send Joe an MP3 of just sort of a rough idea of what, you know, of the musical components for it, with the bass line, the groove, the synthesizers, the you know, the effects, and maybe a couple of vocal effects in there. It's about, generally about, I'd say about 60% done when I send it to him, and he'll say, you know, yeah, that's really great, let's go with it. Or, you know, he'll have a suggestion or two. He'll say, hey, you know, let's do something for the middle section, you know, along these lines. And then I'll spend another, you know, few hours doing that. And then I'll render those out and send them to Joe. And Joe really likes working in Pro Tools. So he'll do the arrangement in Pro Tools.
So you're sending individual tracks or stems?
Yeah, what I do is I send stems. You uh-huh. know, I'll for I mean, it's a dance track, and generally, unless it's a part that evolves over a longer period of time, generally we're talking about 8-bar loops. Huh. So what I'll do is I'll actually send him, I'd say about 16, 20 tracks. You know, everything ranging from, you know, percussion parts to bass lines, to melodies, to chords, to sound effects. Basically, it's a highly customized, you know, loop library, if you will, for him to rearrange and you know, sometimes he'll drop parts out, sometimes he'll bounce a part back to me, and, you know, to add more effects to it, and so on and so forth.
Is he adding anything, or is he just arranging them the way someone might with a loop library?
Occasionally he'll add some drum parts, because he as a DJ, he's got a lot of very specific ideas about the kind of grooves he wants to use in his set. So sometimes he'll tinker with the drum parts. And then, you know, he has a sense of what sort of pacing he wants. When you're doing a remix, there are a million ways to do it. I mean, I personally am partial to the more straightforward, you know, 6, maximum 7-minute remix, whereas other remixers, you know, will go, you know, as long as like 8, 9, 10 minutes long and do these, you know, wild opuses. So Joe has an idea of the kind of story he wants to tell with it. So generally he'll embellish some of the drums and, you know, and then do the arrangement. But all the musical components and a lot of the, you know, the sound effects and so on and so forth, that's me.
Hmm. So with just those 20 little loops or so, you can track it out to 10 minutes or 7 minutes?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Right now there tends to be a movement in several of the sort of genres du jour in the dance scene, electro and tech house, generally are working with a more limited number of components, which is sort of interesting, because I was actually having this conversation with Josh Gabriel a few weeks ago, and Josh pointed out that he had read an article on mixing, and the human ear and the human mind, actually more accurately, can only keep track of 3 threads simultaneously when listening to music. You know, that's bassline, vocal, and rhythmic part, or lead, or hook, or whatever. The other thing that happens is, with automation, the most compelling thing on a dance floor is to, rather than focus on traditional arrangement techniques where you'll have parts sort of coming in and coming out as sort of starting and stopping, you know, maybe fading in, fading out, thanks to automation of everything from synthesis to effects, you can have the same part going, you know, over and over and over again, but, you know, morphing and mutating and sort of variations on a theme, only using parameters instead of melodic motifs.
Hmm.
So what'll happen is it'll evolve, you know, a single part will evolve over the course of 7 minutes to, you know, from a small part all the way up to a peak and then back down to a small part and so on and so forth. So you really don't need that many components as long as you keep them interesting.
Uh-huh. So some of the parameters you might vary would obviously be things like low-pass filtering and possibly panning, things like that?
I'm a big fan of decay.
Uh-huh.
Because you can if you have your like a long decay, you know, and no sustain, you know, as you bring your decay, you can have like a real thick part at the peak with like a really long decay, and then you can immediately come back down to a sort of pointillistic, you know, very percussive sound by bringing the K down to, you know, almost minimum. That's one of my tricks.
And that would be on a MIDI part like a bass line?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or actually a lead. It's really good. It's really good for leads. Because as you bring it in, then you can also, you know, bring up the release as well. So playing with the various envelope parameters. Well, if you really want to get convoluted, what I'll use instead of echo is I'll take a tempo synchronized LFO using a sawtooth pattern, which sort of simulates an echo because it gives you a repeating effect if you apply it to either the filter or the amplifier. So you have this tempo synced LFO at like 16th notes or 8th notes. And if you keep the part very short with a short decay and a short release, you get just the sort of staccato percussive effect. But as you increase the release time, it allows the LFO to carry out more. And it sounds a lot like a tempo synced echo. But since it's working on the synth parameters, it actually takes up less space than an echo, because with an echo you'll have multiple, you know, you'll have multiple overlapping notes that may or may not work together. But when it's just the synth, you know, the notes are cutting off, especially if you bring it down to two voices or something like that. Uh-huh. So it's a lot cleaner that way.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, also backing up a bit, you said when you get the initial tracks, you listen to the vocal, if there is mm-hmm. one, and see mm-hmm. where it leads you. What types of things are you listening for?
A very airy vocal is going to lend itself to a different type of production quality than a vocal that's, you know, more aggressive. If you have an aggressive vocal, you can't be having like sort of lush, airy, atmospheric pads, you know, and sort of floating leads. If you've got, I mean, you can theoretically, but it doesn't reinforce the vibe. So I'm really looking at sort of the emotional energy of the vocal. Is it aggressive? Is it breathy? Is it, you know, is it a male vocal? Is it a female vocal? Those characteristics are going to dictate what's going to work best in context with it.
Mm-hmm. So you've got your vocal. I imagine you play with the tempo a lot as well.
Yeah. There are certain BPM ranges that I like to work in. Every remixer has their own sort of preferred tempo range. These days, I'm partial to like, you know, 124 to 128 BPM.
Hmm.
So if I get a vocal in that's, you know, much slower than that, I'll bring it up. It depends on what time stretching algorithm you're using. I mean, if it's like 30, 40 BPM off, you know, a lot of times you'll get like a hip hop track, for instance, where the BPM is really, really slow. And, you know, problematic tempos tend to be in the, you know, the 100 BPM range, because you can't, you know, it's very hard to get it up 28 BPM, and you can't, you know, do halftime with it. So it's, you know, I would be loath to have to deal with a remix, you know, of that nature.
Uh-huh.
So, but generally the tracks I get are in the, you know, like 118, and I just have to bring them up like, you know, 6 or 7 BPM. So.
And you use Live for that?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I'm real happy with the time stretching algorithms in Live. I mean, I'll play around with the different, you know, sometimes I'll use Complex, sometimes I'll use Tones. Those are the two I generally use for vocals.
Uh-huh. Do you ever get to the point where you actually have to almost rexify it, chop up the vocal into syllables to make it fit?
Yeah, that's exactly what I did for the new hook in the Martin Ten Velden remix that I did with Joe for a track called I Wish You Would. I went in and found different notes in the vocal and sliced it up and created a new pattern from that. I'd used it, that I did, you know, prior to Live 7 being available to me. So, but I've always been a big fan of what I call digital glossolalia.
which is
you know, well, glossolalia is the sort of speaking in tongues language that you know, shamans and evangelists you know will do. They'll fall in a trance and speak in these, you know, various inspired spiritual tongues. And if you can get that same effect by taking an existing vocal and sort of slicing it into eighth note segments, and then finding the good notes and the, you know, the good sort of syllables in there, and then resequencing them either in the time. I mean, in the case of Martin Ten Velden, I just did it. I just took the parts and resequenced them in the timeline itself in the arrange window. But with this new feature called Slice to MIDI Track, in Live, you can do like really, really complicated things, because it's sort of like Rex on steroids, where you can take any loop. Any looped audio in Live, and right click on it, and select slice to MIDI track. And what that does is it slices the loop either on based on the warp markers or note durations. It slices it into up to 128 segments, and then puts each of those in its own simpler. So each slice gets its own simpler, which and its own signal path, which can be processed however you want. And then it creates a MIDI sequence of all those. So it's this sort of, you know, sort of Mondo Dr. Rex tool, which is sort of neat about Ableton, because they, you know, like I was saying this earlier, that they'll take an existing concept and they'll perfect it, and they'll go, oh, yeah, this is the way it was supposed to have been done in the first place. Mm-hmm. And you'll start working with it, and, you know, anything less will, you know, just be, you know, mortifying.
So conceptually, the simpler is their very basic software sampler module, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So each syllable has its own, you could imagine each syllable being a little rack mount sampler in this kind of big reason rack of doom.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Each syllable, or if you use a drum loop, or if you, you know, use a synth part, I mean, any bit of audio is fair game here. So each one, each, you know, slice gets its own synth followed by its own, you know, effects chain. So, uh-huh. You know, if you want to have, you know, one syllable, you know, have like, you know, a low pass filter with a high resonance, and then a sort of, you know, snappy filter envelope, followed by a reverb, followed by a bit crusher, not a problem. And then you take another syllable, you know, maybe, you know, a half measure away from that, you know, and you want to run that through, you know, give that a high pass filter, you know, followed by a flanger, followed by a delay. Again, you know, you can definitely fall down a rabbit hole and be lost for days working in that kind of mode.
Yeah, I'm starting to see how you can stretch 20 loops into a 10-minute piece.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, using all those techniques.
So when you're doing a remix, the basic ingredients you have are the vocal, if there is one, whatever hooks you can identify or right, characteristic right. sounds. And then right. you would pick a drum groove next, I guess?
Yeah, I'm a four on the floor guy. Some breaks guys prefer more syncopation in their kick drums. I generally like four on the floor. And what I'll do is I'll put a kick drum underneath the vocal. And I'll audition several. I generally have like four or five that I turn to on a semi-regular basis.
Hmm.
And I'll get my four on the floor down, and I'll listen. And I'll say that the most important thing is to synchronize the vocal with the kick drum, and you make sure that, you know, your time stretching and everything's in line. Once that's done, I'll pick a snare and I'll just do a kick and snare part. And then I'll start thinking about, well, okay, well, how do I want to syncopate this? Do I want to take it in a more aggressive direction and, you know, maybe add some, you know, 909 toms with a little bit of distortion on them? Do I want to add some 808 congas? If I'm going to use vintage drum machines, I'm partial clearly to the Roland stuff. I really love the CR78 because it, you know, nothing adds vibe to a track like a swarm of insects. so I'll use the CR78, which has a very insectile sound, which is where that remark came from. I'll use the CR78, I'll use the 808, I'll use the 909. Lately, I've been kind of getting a little kitschy with the 80s sounds and grabbing like old Lynn drum sounds and DMX sounds, the Oberheim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, listening to your samples on your music page, I was wondering if there's some kind of law that people had to use a four on the floor kick drum.
No, that's just my sound. I mean, there are different genres like, you know, breaks and drum and bass, clearly. There, if you go to Beatport and just sift around, you know, on their genres page, you'll hear that, you know, some grooves are more syncopated in the, you know, in terms of the kick drum,
mm-hmm.
whereas you know, others are that straight four on the floor. It all depends on. I like four on the floor. It's one of those. It you know, keeps you in that sort of that sort of state of, you know, trance.
Mm-hmm. Now, are your kicks then metronomically locked to the beat, or do you move them around a bit?
No, they're locked to the beat.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Do you ever vary the tempo within a remix, or is that pretty solid as well?
No.
Well, okay. I was about to say absolutely not, never. I personally haven't done it yet, but I'm not averse to the idea because I've heard it done really, really well if you do it in the breakdown of a track. That said, it's absolutely nightmarish to try to import one of those tracks into Ableton Live. And Ableton Live is what I used, you know, for my DJing.
Mm-hmm.
So when you drop a track like that into Ableton Live, Ableton Live all of a sudden wants to, like, put all these warp markers in the middle of it, you know, to try to, you know, keep track of it, which is, you know, it's doing its job. It's being very dutiful as a, you know, as a software enabler, but but ideally you don't want that to happen. And changing the tempo even a few BPM, it's an old pop music trick or a rock trick. You know, drummers will tend to rush a little bit during the chorus and pick up the tempo slightly and then bring it back down in the verses. But in a dance track, you really don't want to do that because you might have another track locked to it.
Exactly.
Frequently, you know, when I'm DJing, a lot of tracks will have, you know, drum intros and drum outros. And to create a real seamlessness, one of sort of my trademarks as a DJ is I'll let the drums from the previous track, I'll have them looped and live, and I'll let them just ride for like over the first 2 minutes of the next track, and then I'll use like filters or delays or echoes or various effects or just a volume ride, you know, to slowly segue out of that. But you know, having just the drums going at the end of the track allows the mix to be almost completely seamless, where you just can't tell where one track ends and the other begins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that kind of brings us back to that idea of pacing and the kind of the emotional curve of the mix as you're doing it. Since you can't vary the tempo, what are some other ways that you can help the track breathe a bit?
Well, it's what the kinds of parts that are in it. It's sort of, you know, minimal versus maximal. You know, you start with your stripped down drums and your percussion. You gradually add elements. And it's very, very popular now to add a very short break about a minute and a half into the track, where all of the drums will drop out and like some sort of instrumental part, you know, rhythmic or floaty even, will proceed for about 8 to 16 measures. And then the track will come right back in with the bass and, you know, the whole groove going. You can build using the morphing techniques that I described earlier, you know, changing your envelopes and so on and so forth, adding, subtracting elements, making it very sparse during certain periods, and then making it very dense in others. And then in generally one of the sort of rules of the medium is approximately 4 minutes into your track, you'll have a very long break that, mm-hmm. you know, that lasts generally 32 measures. And that gives everybody a chance to sort of, you know, breathe and look around and, you know, take a little break from dancing. But then it swells to a crescendo, you know, a big peak. And then the final choruses or the, you know, the peak of the track comes back in, and then it disassembles, you know, over the next 2 to 3 minutes, and the process starts all over again with the next track.
Uh-huh. Maybe we can zap over to gear a little bit. I'm kind of curious if maybe you could describe your setup right now and how you can make that translate into the huge sound systems and clubs.
I, after many, many, many years of using lots and lots and lots and lots of equipment, I've actually, in the past 3-4 months, dropped my rig down to 3 components, and that's Ableton Live, the Dave Smith Instruments Prophet 08, and the M-Audio EX66s. That's it. That's what I use for everything. It's really, really streamlined, but it's super, super efficient and very, very, yeah, everything I need to do, I can do from that rig. I'd used another brand of speakers, which had been sort of the standard for many, many years, and you'll see them in pretty much every project studio and even larger studios. I don't want to mention any names because I don't want to diss anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But I recently reviewed the M-Audio EX66s for keyboard, and after about a week of using them, I just got on the horn to M-Audio and said, okay, how much do you want for these? They have a really unique design in that they're very, very tall, and people want to put them on their side, and you can't because they need to be used in the vertical position. And there's a pair of 6-inch woofers on the speakers, which, you know, if you're familiar with 6-inch woofers, you generally think that, well, these can't really reproduce low end. But when you got two of them, they do.
Hmm.
And then in the center, there's a tweeter. And these speakers, the one term that I've never really used when describing the sound of speakers is detailed low end. And the EX66s actually have detailed low end. You can actually hear a lot of, you know, very, very interesting information in the, say, 60 hertz to 250 hertz range that you just don't hear with other speakers.
Hmm.
They're not as bombastic I mean, a lot of people really want that, you know, giant sound, but I'm more interested in hearing what's actually going on than, you know, having, you know, a sense around experience with my speaker.
At least, do these come with a subwoofer, or is you're not even using that?
No, they work without them. They sound great without them. You could attach, I mean, theoretically, if you really, really want, you know, to goose everything below 150 hertz, you could definitely get a subwoofer and throw it in the mix. But I generally prefer to not have that and just really, really hear what's in the track.
So what type of reality checking do you do afterwards? Do you do the old test in the car?
It's the Toyota factory stereo system test. If it sounds good on a factory Toyota stereo system, it's, you know, in your car, it's gonna sound great everywhere. There's something about using a mid-range car stereo, factory installed. You know, you don't want anything that's too bling. If it sounds good on that, it's going to sound good everywhere. There's that, and you know, if it's a final release, I'll definitely take it to one of the clubs that I spin at, and either I'll spin it or I'll have another DJ friend of mine spin it. You know, during downtime at the club, so I can hear it on a big system.
What are some of the things that would jump out that would surprise you?
It's usually bass. It's usually, is there too much or too little bass? You know, making sure that, you know, because there's so much energy in that frequency range that if you've got too much, it really, really imbalances the whole mix. So more than anything, it's getting the low end right for me.
We were talking about surround sound effects before. How much do you do with the stereo or the processing?
I generally leave that for the ambiences. Every once in a while, I'll have a keyboard part that's sort of bouncing around, or I'll use a ping pong delay. But my mixes are generally, you know, power mono. Again, like with the kick and the snare are always right up the middle. You've got of course, your bass is always right up the middle. Sometimes I'll have like hi-hats and percussive effects. I'll have them, you know, slightly panned, you know, maybe 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock. That's generally about as far as I go. And then, of course, if it's a stereo reverb, I let that be a big stereo reverb, pads and ambiences. But when you have stuff swirling around too much, you know, again, it can detract from your mix if you've got too much motion. So it's a matter of really picking and choosing the elements that are going to have that ambience or that, you know, that motion, and limiting it to one or two, for me at least.
The part I was really intrigued by was just the discipline that you have in throwing away, you know, as a product reviewer, you must have 15 linear feet of shrink wrapped music software at your disposal waiting for you to plug into any project you want to use. How do you resist that and just focus on what you described as your live plus Prophet 08 setup?
A little known fact is that I'm also a college professor. I've been a college professor for 12 years now in Austin, Texas, and I teach electronic music courses here. And I always tell my students that it is so much more valuable to pick one tool and know that tool inside and out than to have, you know, a passing knowledge of, you know, 50,000 tools. For all of the value that Logic Studio provides, and it really is absolutely, I mean, I just reviewed it for keyboard, and when I saw that package, I was like, I cannot believe how much really high quality stuff you get for $500. You know, I remember the days where it's like, you know, I'd spend, you know, if we're looking at a bass sound, well, do I want to use Sculpture? Do I want to use ES2? Do I want to use ES1? You know, you can fall down this, you know, as I said earlier, a rabbit hole where you get this option anxiety, you know, where am I using the right sound, or God forbid, you know, and this is always a very dangerous path, is to layer stuff. You know, where you have, you know, five layers just doing a single pad, there's no room for anything else. You know, you get into the masking effect where, you know, when two instruments share overlapping frequencies, the louder one masks the quieter one. And if you've got four instruments sharing overlapping frequencies, you might as well just have a sawtooth pad with a little bit of chorusing. So, you know, it gets to that. So it's really, really important, circling back to the original question, if you have one tool like Live, which is so completely flexible, you can use it for your DJing, you can use it for mixing, you can use it for improvisational composition, you can use it for live PA. It really is a one-stop piece of software that's so elegantly designed and so intuitive that you really can, I mean, if it
if it weren't a piece of software, I'd marry it. It's that it just does absolutely everything that I need an audio or a music piece of software to do. And it does it intelligently and it does it intuitively. And like the Mac operating system itself, it just, it gets out of the way and allows me to create. So Live is what I use for, you know, all of my sampling, my arranging, my sequencing, my processes. The new compressors are absolutely top notch. Quite a few users, you know, felt that, that they had to use third party compressors with, you know, versions prior to 7. But Live 7, the compressor is just gorgeous, and they've got 64-bit summing buses and all that. So working in Live 7 is, you know, that's my primary tool. And then, you know, over the years, I've used a lot of modeled analog soft synths. I started using, you know, analog synths when I was, you know, a teenager. I used, you know, a Poly 6 and, you know, an old Moog and, you know, Oberheim Expander. And then I moved into soft synths, and I was like, oh, wow, I can have it all on my laptop. And I honestly forgot how good analog sounded. I mean, we, you know, during the whole 90s, you know, an analog synth was a Nord Lead. And, you know, Nord Lead sound are great, and they're good for what they are, but they're not analog synths, you know. So when the Prophet came out, you know, I had recently actually dug out my SH-101 and started using that in tracks, and that had just such a wild character, a really rich, in-your-face warmth. And I was like, okay, when the Prophet 8 came out, I got that review, and I was like, oh my god, I don't have to EQ this stuff. It's amazing. If you can do a bass patch on the Prophet, and it requires no additional processing. It sits exactly in the proper spot in the audio spectrum. There's just such a presence about it. So the combination of sampling with Live, doing my processing with Live, and then having the sort of, you know, the presence and balls of the Prophet, and then being able to hear everything accurately on the EX66s, it streamlines the whole process and makes it possible for me to make music, you know, in a stress-free, fluid way.
Yeah, I remember when I saw you at Macworld, you were saying that you don't even use many third-party plugins with your Live system.
Yeah, it's not that I don't use any. Some of the third-party stuff that I've used in the past year or so that I think is really hot is I really think Arturia did an incredible job with the Jupiter 8. Jupiter 8 was always one of those synths that I desperately wanted as a kid but couldn't get my family to shell out $4,000 for some reason. So having, you know, finally, you know, sort of getting my hands on the Jupiter 8, they, like I said, they did a good job with it. So that's a really nice plug. I don't like the dongle, but I do like the sound.
Speaking of plugs.
Yeah, that's the other, yeah. I mean, I'm anti-dongle. I could go on for days about that. And then one of the other plugins that I really like is, the G-Force Mellotron. I mean, the Mellotron being the first sampler, I don't really feel that I'm losing out that much by using a soft version of the Mellotron as opposed to having a real one. I don't know that I would want a real one.
Yeah.
So, you know, so if I need that, those amazing choirs that only the Mellotron did, then, you know, I'll use the M-tron for that. But generally, the Rob Papin stuff, I mean, I hear a lot of stuff. There's a lot of great stuff out there. I'm just trying to streamline my own workflow. I mean, I could go on about stuff I love, like the Rob Papin stuff is great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Blue and Predator are both really, really, really hot synths. And, you know, I'll use certain, you know, sample libraries every once in a while to, you know, for not so much for synth parts, never for synth parts, but every once in a while for like a drum sound or, you know, just sort of a placeholder loop that I'll replace with something else.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that's really, really hard to get right when you're sequencing is the vibe of like a really nice sort of shaker pattern or a hi-hat groove that's got like a sort of live kind of motion to it. So occasionally I'll rely on loops for that. Not that often, but every once in a while, I'll, you know, for the high-end sort of shimmying parts groove, I'll use loop libraries for that. But generally, I really try to keep it just down to the essentials.
Huh. So you're basically using MIDI rather than loops as you build up your compositions?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Interesting. Okay.
I've actually become fond of MIDI timing slop. you know, now that I'm, you know, I mean, having used soft synths for so long, you know, there's a certain precision because there is no latency. Once it's sequenced and everything is happening
in software, there is no latency. All of the parts are exactly on time. And anything that you want that, you know, that adds funk to that groove, you've got to dial in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started working with the Prophet, I fired it up via MIDI, and I, you know, Dave invented MIDI. So of course it's got an amazing MIDI implementation, and it's really fast and really responsive. But MIDI itself has a defined latency that is generally, you know, can be anywhere from, you know, we'll say 10 to, depending on the vintage of the synth, 10 to 30 milliseconds. It also depends on what, you know, what controller data is coming down the pipe. And I noticed that there was a certain kind of quirk to using hardware that added, you know, exactly the right kind of groove to the track that I never used to get with soft synths. And, you know, I mean, back in the 80s, I was hating on that. But, you know, now that I have control over, I mean, of course, if I want to move it around, I can. I can, you know, change the, you know, the latency compensation, the track delay on Ableton Live, or I can, you know, put warp markers in and slice it up and so on and so forth. But I like the little wiggle that I get from MIDI slop.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, to wrap up, and maybe we can continue this some other time, another sure. 6 months when you're free again. I want to talk a bit about the Remixer's Bible and some of the insights you've got through teaching.
The interesting thing about the Remixer's Bible is I've been reading Keyboard Magazine since I was a teenager, which I hate to say this, but it was during the 80s. I don't want to give you an exact year because I don't want anybody to know how ancient I am. But when I was a teenager in the 80s, I grew up reading Keyboard Magazine and learning my craft because there weren't schools. I mean, there wasn't a full sale back then. You know, there wasn't, you know, we didn't have electronic music courses at the local college like we do now. If you wanted to learn the craft of synthesis, you would have to either teach yourself, you know, through books and experiment and owning a synth and experimentation, or find an apprenticeship at an area recording studio. So I grew up reading Keyboard Magazine. And I learned from, like, Craig Anderton and Jim Aiken and so on and so forth. So when I took on the Dance Mix column in 2000, and I'd been, you know, I've been writing that for going on, I guess we're looking at like 8-9 years now. I realized about a year and a half ago that there was enough material over, if you just looked at what was in Keyboard Magazine from, say, you know, 97 onward, there was enough material to create a manual for making great dance music. If you just went back through the archives, you know, the material that I wrote, some really, really insightful stuff from Jim Aiken, some great stuff from Craig. Doug Beck, my predecessor in the Dance Mix column, he had a ton of really, really great pieces and insights because, you know, he's a terrific remixer in his own right. So I just went through the keyboard archives and figured out what was still relevant to today's market. I kept a combination of hardware and software. I covered some older stuff because not everybody has the chance to upgrade their rig every 6 months, like professionals and people in the, you know, music technology business can. So I wanted to keep a balance of, you know, old and new. And then I found a bunch of anecdotes from the interviews that we did with all of these dance artists, like Armin van Helden and, you know, Cascade and Miguel Miggs and BT. There's a ton of great stuff from BT.
Oh, yeah.
So I found all that interview material, as well as the tutorial material. And I thought, wow, we've got enough for like a really cool book. What should I call it? And I thought, well, you know, what's the most arrogant thing I can call this book but a Bible? So in an act of hubris, I took all of this great data from Keyboard Magazine and folded it all into one big book. And then took, I contacted a few of my friends in the business, and like Gabriel and Dresden and Jacinta and so on and so forth. And I asked them, hey, would you be willing to contribute some Ableton Live files so people can actually take the stuff that's in the book and do their own remixes with your tracks? And, you know, artists like, you know, Meat Manifesto was involved, Cold Cut was involved. They all very generously allowed us to include these Ableton Live files. So that readers can read the book and try the stuff out with real live, honest-to-goodness music.
For links to the Remixer's Bible and everything else Francis Prev mentioned in this episode, See the show notes at digitalmedia.oreilly.com. You can find many more musical examples at his site, fap7.com. We also recorded another whole episode on sound design. Subscribe to Digital Media Insider at iTunes, and you'll get it for free as soon as it comes out. You've been listening to Digital Media Insider, the official podcast of the O'Reilly Digital Media site. Visit us at digitalmedia.oreilly.com. That's O-R-E-I-L-L-Y. And let us know what creative technologies you'd like to explore. As always, I wrote this music using software that I learned about while editing articles for the site. See the show notes for links. For O'Reilly Digital Media, I'm David Bettino.
Oh, no. Well, okay.